There was a time when farmers grew food with shovels, hoes, and horses. As technology progressed, they used tractors, fertilizers, and pesticides. Today, farmers are growing food by stringing together binary digits of yes and no. That leads us to ask, can software regenerate agriculture?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,393rd, easy to get confused on that one. But at any rate, 1,393 editions of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Port Villa who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we begin with Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Without the food made available by a successful agriculture, we all become hunters and gatherers, turning over logs, looking for things to eat. And hunters and gatherers do not have the time to build the sandcastles in which we all live. It is easy for us city people to forget this elemental fact. Most of our food, after all, comes from an average of 1,200 miles away, in plastic packages affixed with colorful and promising labels. Given how easy it is to eat, it is also easy for us to forget how important that distant agriculture is to our day-to-day lives. It is easy to forget that farmland and farmers must be sustained and even regenerated so we can leave the means for future farmers to grow food so future people can build their sandcastles. There are some who say that given the world's exploding population, sustaining and regenerating farmland sufficient to feed everyone is an impossibility. For example, 1968's The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich began with, "The battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. At this late date, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate." The world's population in 1968 was 3.545 billion. Today it's 8.213 billion. Ehrlich's prediction of doom did not come true because technology, specifically that of the Green Revolution, increased the production of agriculture, making it possible to more than double the world's population. But the truth that the population bomb did point to is that for the world's population to continue growing, its agriculture must continue to be sustained and regenerated with technology. And so we ask, can software sustain and regenerate agriculture, farms, and farmers? Well, here to help us answer that question, we have Dan Ryan, who is the CEO of SIBO Technologies, a climate software company. Dan, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to have the discussion.
You have run a number of software companies, I see, and are now CEO of SIBO Technologies, a software company that serves farmers. As such, I guess you're a farmer too, when it gets right down to it. So the question I have to ask you is that as you were growing into the world of software, did you ever think you would become a farmer?
No, I did not. I had the good fortune of working on a dairy farm of my relatives for a couple of summers, which...
And that takes care of everything, right? Once you've worked on a dairy farm for a couple of summers?
Yeah. So that was a great experience for me. I wish everybody could have it, but I didn't expect I'd become a farmer. I didn't expect that I'd be involved in technology platform that was in agriculture either, because that was a new domain for me.
Well, and it is a significant domain for software companies because a lot of software and hardware technology companies are entering into agriculture to, I guess, sustain and regenerate agriculture in a way that we can continue growing the world's population. That's the objective, right?
Yeah. I think it's, you know, the largest industry on Earth. It represents a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, maybe around 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. And so it's a very big impact on our planet. And also, you mentioned how we've been able to grow enough food to support this growing population. But the way we've been doing it, you know, in sort of conventional farming, definitely has a negative impact on both the soil and the resilience of the food system. You know, we've been able to grow the production and the output and the yield sufficiently to feed everybody. But there's been, you know, consequences of doing that that we need to figure out how to reverse in order to keep the system alive for future generations.
True on a number of different fronts, too, climate being one of them. But isn't that not true that this is the first time in the history of the human race or human civilization that farmers have become somewhat responsible for climate? Is this something relatively new here?
Yeah, I think it's new. I hesitate to say they're responsible. I think we're responsible, you know, for ensuring that the farmers have the tools and incentives and motivation to do the things we need them to do to make the food system, you know, resilient under these new climate conditions and also to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But I think it's the society's responsibility, not the farmers. I think the farmers, you know, are the people that have to help implement the solutions. But I think it's kind of a collective responsibility across all of us, including individuals, but also the companies that are, you know, producing the food and people that are involved in the entire value chain. I think have a shared responsibility.
And where is SIBO Technologies in that agriculture food chain, as it were?
Sure. So SIBO Technologies is a science-based software platform that focuses on, you know, on two sides of the problem. One side is how do we get a farmer to adopt regenerative agriculture practices, cover crop, no-till, reduce nitrogen, biodiversity, you know, water use. How do you get them to adopt those practices? They cost money. They add risk to the operation. And so what we try to do is they need some incentive to get them through the path of transitioning to regenerative practices. It costs money. They need agronomic support to make those practices successful, to reduce the risk of new practices. You know, they've been doing this a certain way for many years, and adding a new practice to an operation adds risk to their operation. So I think the two things on the farmer side is incentive dollars, agronomic support to help them make the transition. Until we provide that sufficiently, it will happen over time. Many farmers do it on their own, but to do it at scale, I don't think will happen. On the other side, are people trying to sponsor willing to sponsor farmers to do new practices, and they may want to take credit for it in the form of an emission reduction or in the form of a carbon credit or in the form of a label on a package, or it may be the government, you know, the USDA or NRCS that are willing to sponsor this. How do you, you know, the other side of our equation is helping those sponsor organizations effectively deploy, cost efficiently and effectively deploy programs to farmers. So we, you know, have a software platform and network that tries to connect those two ends of the food chain from the sponsors, the food companies, the fuel companies, textile governments, to the farmer to help incent them. Once these farmers have done these practices for a few years, and there's, you know, not debate, but there's difference of opinion how long that takes. But after a few years, they become self-sustaining. Typically, the farmer can be making, you know, is more profitable from higher productivity and less inputs required. And then the land becomes more valuable because it's more profitable. And so, but you have to get through this transition period, whether that's 4 years or 7 years or whatever it might be. And that's really our focus, is helping identify sponsors and help them deploy their programs to farmers.
I've done a number of shows with farmers, heartland farmers, who have made the transition from what used to be considered conventional agriculture to regenerative agriculture. And oftentimes, you know, that a younger person's taking over the farm from his parents or something, and his parents always look at him and say, what the heck are you doing? You can't do things that way. It doesn't make any financial sense at all. And yet, after a few years, the farm is transformed into a regenerative kind of agriculture in which the soil is being built up. The grasses are growing much healthier. The crops are healthier. And then the senior family member goes, well, okay, I guess you were right. I guess all of the things that we were doing forever needed to be changed. So there is a lot of impetus for change, but there is also a lot of resistance to it. So you have both of those things to deal with then.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that I don't know if it's resistance to change, it's risk aversion. You know, is what's causing resistance. I think
that's a good name for it.
yeah. I think it's more of that. But you're right. People have been doing it. You know, there's an old phrase, they only have 40 seasons, right? And they've been doing it a certain way. And adding risk in 1 year is adding risk. And I think it's a behavior change challenge, just like, you know, healthcare or saving for retirement or whatever. How do you look at the long term benefit of doing these things today? And how do you present that long-term benefit? And part of that is as I said, the incentive and support and tools needed during the transition so you can get them to the long-term benefit. And some people I think most people recognize that. It's just, what's the impetus to get them to go there? But, you know, more and more people are doing it on their own. I think that people have a high regard for passing high-quality land on to the next generation. I think that, you know, farmers are very motivated internally to, you know, keep quality land. I think that the more volatile weather we have now, you know, the more droughts and more floods makes it almost more of a requirement. If I want to have a consistent yield as the weather is going up and down and in a given year, these are things that I need to do to ensure that I can have a yield and a consistent yield in dry weather or wet weather. And that's one of the things I think more and more people are realizing. And I think that's what we need to ensure. And that's where the food companies look at that as, this is my supply chain. How do I ensure I need to make food in the future. How do I ensure my supply chain is, you know, secure and safe and resilient? And that's, you know, I think what the balance is how do you get that transition to occur more quickly?
I think when it gets right down to it, those on both sides of the supply chain, the producers and the consumers, all have one thing in common. We all want to reduce the costs. And I think that as conventional agriculture became more expensive by virtue of the inputs being put into it, that had a lot to do with the thought that maybe there is a better way, a regenerative way. And that's where we would like to go after we come back from this break. I am Michael Olson. This is the Food Chain Radio program. We have Dan Bryan with us, who is the CEO of SIBO Technologies, which is he strings together digital bytes of zeros and ones into this long program called a software program. And you can use that. And we're going to talk about how he uses that to make it possible for farmers to practice regenerative agriculture, not just farmers, but all of us when it gets right down to it, because we're all in need of a successful agriculture. So do stay tuned. We will be right back.
back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. This is the Food Chain. We are talking regenerative and sustainable agriculture. Very big words, Dan Ryan, CEO of SIBO Technology. And they've been bandied about significantly within agriculture communities for a number of years. But when I hear the term regenerative, I always think of a book written by F.H. King, who was long ago the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture for the United States. In the year 1900, he put out a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries. And he had traveled to Asia to see how people were growing food there. And what he discovered was that farmers on very small parcels of land had been farming the same parcel of land for 40 centuries, 4,000 years. And in spite of not having any of the technologies of modern times, were sustaining a population of 400 million people within China on these little tiny parcels of land. And so for 40 centuries, my goodness, that is sustainable and obviously regenerative. So when we talk about regenerative agriculture in modern times, we kind of come to the grips with what exactly does that mean. Now, in China, the government is moving people off those small farms and into the cities to work in factories. And so that technology that lasted people for 40 centuries is being dissipated on a factory floor. And so China's going to have to come up with a new kind of regenerative agriculture, as we are as well, simply to maintain the increase in population. And you're part of that effort. So what do you mean by regenerative agriculture?
Sure. I think there's a lot of terms bandied about, as you said, sustainable agriculture. Conservation agriculture is what the USDA still refers to these programs, and they've been doing this since the Dust Bowl. And I think
and they were right
to kind of reflect the difference from conventional agriculture, which was full till, no cover crop, you know, abundant use of fertilizers, minimum, you know, buffer zones around waterways, you know, the things that were done to kind of farm edge to edge and generate as much yield as we could. And regenerative was taken to say, let's layer on practices that actually improve soil carbon, improve wildlife habitat, and improve water quality. And there's a litany of those things. If you go to the NRCS USDA programs, there's, you know, hundreds of practices that they recommend, from doing certain tillage practices to putting birdhouses on farms, right? But in the core of it, what I think is typically meant today would be adding practices like reduced tillage, going to no-till or some reduced tillage intensity to protect soil carbon, adding cover crops to add soil carbon and protect erosion, trying to reduce nitrogen to reduce the footprint of producing nitrogen and also reduce nitrogen runoff and leaching. There's many, many, many others. Biodiversity is a common one. But that's kind of the basic things people think about, generally speaking, today as regenerative practices. And I think that one of the challenges we face in funding them is that there's not a market for them yet. You know, when they created organic farming, they created here's a new aisle in the grocery store where the organic things, and people pay a premium, and the consumers decide to pay a premium for it. And we haven't achieve that with regenerative agriculture yet. There's some people labeling them and trying to move that way, but we don't have that. Here's food made regeneratively by the good companies, and here's food not made regeneratively by the bad companies, for example. So there's a little bit of a challenge of how do you finance these things, because, you know, the consumers, even if they're willing to pay for it, don't have a way to. And as you noted earlier, the prices have gone up to, you know, where the cost of food is already high. You know, and if the food companies and textile companies, if the consumers aren't paying for it and they're doing the work, then it means the shareholders are paying for it, which they also don't probably want to pay for it. So there's a little bit of trick about how do you fund these things. Right. I think as you look forward, but that will happen. I think the food companies are committed long-term to causing this transition to happen for many reasons, that one of which is really the resilience of their supply chain.
Good.
So I think you can use those terms interchangeably. I think conservation is the oldest one. I think regenerative is the newest one. And I think that they're somewhat overlapping, I guess.
So in a very real respect, we're all trying to become farmers of 40 centuries in modern times here in different worlds. But still, that's the objective, is how we keep things going and feed the population and make enough money to keep going to do it. So SIBO Technologies is a software program that does what?
Sure. So we're a software program that will take a sponsor program from, a food company or the government.
Now, what do you mean by sponsored program?
Oh, so a program could be, for example, in the case of the food companies, they're focused on their scope 3 or their supply chain emissions reductions. Okay. Agriculture is a huge part of, the emissions, greenhouse gas emissions in the world. They're focused on reducing their footprint as they have these net zero targets. So virtually all the food companies have signed up for, and textile companies and others have really adopted net zero objectives. And so
net zero means net zero carbon emissions.
Yep. Yep. And for that company, and their net zero objectives in the case of food companies, some, I don't know the exact number, but maybe it's 70-80% of their emissions are in their supply chain. They don't have only 20 or 30% are direct, they can use renewable energy on their factories and whatever, but a big piece of their emissions is the supply chain, which is somewhat unique in agriculture and food. So they have a large emphasis on how to reduce emissions in their supply chain, which is agriculture. And they're creating programs, and that's called Scope 3 emissions reduction, that they will sponsor or incent a farmer to do these practices, and then they want to take credit for the emissions reductions that were caused.
Wait a minute. I sense money.
True. They're paying money in this case.
Okay. All right. So, okay.
Paying money to the farmer to do this. And, another example of that, which is related, are people generate carbon credit offsets from agriculture. That's a different type of a sponsor. Another type of a sponsor might be a federal or local government that's sponsoring, or a watershed that's sponsoring programs. So money coming into the system to incent farmers to do something. And that's what we do. But when you're incenting a farmer to do something for Scope 3 or a carbon credit, for example, you have to somehow quantify the impact of the practice. So our software platform has a science and modeling element that it can actually model and quantify on that field. If a farmer does that practice, what is the impact on emissions or on the impact on soil carbon sequestration? So as part of the software platform, we have this below the farmers don't see this, and the food companies don't see it, but below the waterline, we have all the science running that's trying to say, what's the impact of doing this practice on this field? In other words, how much credit can one of these sponsors take for that practice on that field? And we help them make those plans and, how to deploy a program that will achieve their objectives for that year. In the case of the NRCS, USDA, they've been at this longer than anybody, which, like since the Dust Bowl, they've been doing things. And I think that they take a less, let's say, emissions or carbon-related quantification. Their focus is on that field, there's a what's called resource concern. There's a problem. And if you adopt this practice to solve that problem, we will pay you. And so they don't really focus much on what the outcome from a measured outcome perspective is. They just care about, did you do the right practice on that field, and we'll pay you for that. So they're not trying to quantify anything that happened. They know that if I do, a cover crop, or if I take bad land out of production and put grass on it, that's good and that's enough. So they're a little bit unique in the sense that they're not trying to quantify the impact, but they've done a great job of figuring out how to deploy how to design programs that solve real problems.
So they're not grading anybody on their effort. They're just saying, if you made the effort, that's good.
Yeah. They're grading you on they're grading you on the effort to do it, not on what the resultant impact on carbon or emissions or anything else might be. It's like they know if you do this, that's what their objective is, to accomplish this conservation objective.
So what SIBO has done, I think, if I'm seeing this correctly, is that they've collected all of this information about the impact of these programs, and can then pretty much make some grades.
Yes, that's a good way of saying that. We have a lot of data that we collect. We have for every field in the country. We have to know the soil data. We have to know the weather data. We have to have satellite imagery. Know the practice history.
Now, did you say every field?
Yes, every acre, and then we can run on that field our simulation engine, which is a little bit technical, but it's a biomechanistic model from Michigan State University that grows a plant on a day step basis in that field with that soil, with that nitrogen, with that sunlight. And that model is used to understand the interaction of fertilizer with soil and soil carbon, with biomass, with yield, all the things that we actually model on that field. And so we can what if model, what if I did this new practice on this field, what would be the impact on soil carbon? What would be the emissions reduction? What would be the nitrogen leaching? You know, those kinds of things we actually are able to model. So that's a kind of a deep science that is baked into the software. And one of the other, typically of a program, one of the qualifiers or one of the pre-qualifiers for a conservation or regenerative ag program is practice history. So they want to know what were you doing on that field before. And we're able to use satellite imagery to infer that. We run that through so-called computer vision platform, which uses machine learning and AI, so that we can look at every acre in the country and tell you, what do we believe the cash crop was for the last 7 years? Was there a cover crop? What was the tillage intensity? What was the plant date? All the things that you need to do to develop a program. And we do that also for every acre in the country, which allows you to understand which fields are likely eligible and good fields to be enrolling programs on.
A before and after almost.
Yes.
You know, looking back to those farmers of 40 centuries, they had an incredible amount of knowledge about what worked in the past and what didn't work in the past. When to plant something, when to put a companion crop in, all of these incredible variables that it takes. What was it Thomas Jefferson said? You know, to be a farmer, you have to be a physicist, a biologist, and so on. You had to have all of this knowledge to be able to do this. Seems like that's what you're trying to package in your software program, so you can make these evaluations, because it takes all of those variables and running them together to come up with solutions.
Yeah, I think there's software programs that do specifically around, you know, what an agronomist would use, which plant type, which product placements, how much fertilizer, what's a nutrient management plan. That all that really agronomic oriented precision agriculture, let's say. We don't do that. What we do is we take those inputs and try to understand the impact on the overall plant ecosystem in soil mm-hmm. carbon and nitrogen. And so ours is a simulation model. We don't make that recommendation for how much nitrogen to put on to optimize yield, but we do tell you if you reduce nitrogen, what's the impact, right? And so we kind of take that piece. And I think your analogy on the 40 centuries is interesting. One of the things that we've seen in the States, like everything seems to move more quickly, right? But we've been around for a few hundred years, and we went from a largely farming community to 2%.
Right.
All of our people live in the cities.
We live in the city now.
Yep. 2% of the people farm, right? And so carrying that domain expertise generation to generation, it's maybe an easier problem in some ways now, because it's such a smaller number of 3 million farmers or whatever the number is that they're doing it. And there's still a lot of that. I mean, I think a lot of this is handed down how we farm this land and what's been successful and what our neighbors do. And I think that a lot of that domain is still, tribal knowledge, so to speak. where it is passed along. But now you see these farms scaling up and they're operating on land. 50% of the land now is farmed by tenants or something on that order of magnitude
farmers have become to a great extent contractors. You know, they're assembling all of the pieces like land and equipment and
money
and all of these, bringing all of these things together and making them work. Whereas somebody who lived on a farm for 40 centuries probably had the opportunity to spend a lot of time talking to the neighbors and whatnot and figuring things
out. It's becoming, in many cases, there's still plenty of that, I think, here. But I think in many cases, it's becoming more, it definitely is a business. These are business people making business decisions on trading, on inputs, on every day. And so there's a lot more, and they tend to be getting bigger, right? The farms are getting bigger and becoming bigger businesses. And I think a lot of when a lot of farmers don't own a lot of the land they're farming on, which is a different thing than if you live there for the last five generations, you know, which there's still plenty of people in that situation where they have a multi-generational farm, which is still
there's a lot of people thing, like that. Well, it's my observation that farms are growing in two directions: very, very big, very, very small, and pretty much everything in the middle is roadkill, as you see out in the countryside.
It's interesting. So, by very, very small, you mean organic and specialty?
Specialty, and yes, absolutely. So, farming for the city and whatnot. Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is Food Chain, Michael Olson. When we come back, we're going to take on the big issue, which is climate change and pollution, and how to fix it with Dan Ryan. He's the CEO of SIBO Technologies. Do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freezer. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream, and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. We are talking regenerative agriculture. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, when we pioneered this great country of ours, the United States of America, we found a lot of room to grow. Boy, we could move into the forest, chop it down, plant crops, the crops grew up, and we just cashed out that soil. And when the soil got tired and old, we moved right along. And we kept moving right along until we hit the West Coast here and fell off into the ocean. And then sooner or later, we came to the conclusion that, wait a minute, we have to figure out a better way to do this so we can sustain the land, even regenerate it, so those who come later will be able to farm food, and those who come later will be able to build their sandcastles. And that really started during the Dust Bowl days, during the Great Depression, as Dan Ryan was telling us. The federal government came in and said, okay, farmers, we have to come up with a better way of doing that. And we've been doing that ever since. And Dan Ryan and his SIBO Technologies is part of that effort. Dan, agriculture is said to be a very dirty business with respect to the environment, but why?
I think it's, you know, it's a natural outcome of the way we farm is that we generate, if you care about greenhouse gas emissions, it generates a lot of greenhouse gas emissions from farming. And if you care about the food system resilience, we impact that in a negative way with conventional agriculture. So I think, and then thirdly, there's things like nitrogen runoff and leaching and, you know, water quality or water pollution. There's a lot of different elements that agriculture, I don't think agriculture is setting out to do bad things. I mean, everybody in farming is trying to do good things, but it's a natural byproduct of farming. And I think it's probably even a more natural byproduct of sort of traditional conventional type farming. And I think that the move, like you mentioned, towards more conservation, starting with the government to avoid future dust bowls was a great start. But even today, a small percentage of farmers really apply for and receive those grants. It's, you know, it's certainly not the majority of farmers. It's a small minority of farmers that are doing that work. So there's between that and then commercial programs have not yet scaled. Commercial meaning, as I said, CPG, you know, food company, textile companies that are interested in their supply chain. Those programs have not scaled yet in a big way. So there's still a long ways to go. I mean, we're making good progress chipping away at it, but there's still a long ways to go to get to where there's mass adoption of practices that will maintain or reduce or better the state of the land as it is today.
And SIBO Technologies has developed software to do this. And of course, software is simply a real long string of yeses and nos, binary digits of yeses and nos. And we've come to know how to get along with those binary digits pretty well. And so, first of all, what is the name of your software program that you have on the marketplace?
Yeah, the company, I think originally SIBO is the Italian word for cibo, which is food, but we anglicized it, of course. So it's SIBO Technologies. The product that we sell is called SIBO Impact. That is our software platform that is used by the food and agriculture industry to help deploy and manage sustainability or regenerative agriculture programs on farm. And that's really kind of the end-to-end, as I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. the network between there's a sponsor that's willing to assist a farmer to do a good practice and the farmer doing the practice and making that connection and then reporting back to the sponsor that the farmer did the practice and what was the impact of that, you know, that round trip. Good. Here's a program, implement it, tell me it was implemented and what the impact was. And that's really the round trip that we've tried to provide.
And SIBO is the implement for doing these things.
Yep.
It's like the tractor. Farmers use
like
tractors.
Marketplace or the network or
okay,
how you want
good.
To think about it. Yeah.
So good. Now, its capability seems amazing because you mentioned earlier that you can evaluate any acre in the United States.
Yep. Yeah, so we there's a couple. This may be a little technical, but we do. So we have a model, this simulation model, biomechanistic model that models the growth of the plant on that land and the interaction with all the elements, carbon, fertilizer, sunlight, water. So we can model that land with the model. To run the model, we need to know things like what was the practice history, what's the nitrogen application, what's the tillage intensity. And so we when we enroll a farmer in a program, we ask all those questions. We say, what's your plant day? What's your harvest day? What did you plant last year? Are you willing to do no-till? What's your fertilizer applications? What's the cultivar? We ask all those questions. A farmer enrolls and we run the model to understand the impact of that set of practices. But before we do that, we can run on any acre in the country because we infer those practices. We have a piece of our software is called Agronomo. That's an internal name, but that is an inference engine. So we, for every field in the country, we infer what we think the practices are for that field. So we can run that acre without having any farmer input. And so we can get an estimate. You know, it's not going to be as exact as if a farmer gives us the data when they do ultimately enroll. But before that, we can get an estimate of what's happening on that land. We can tell you, for example, for the state of Iowa, what's the carbon intensity of corn in 2021 for the entire state. And so we can run those calculations without any farmer data, which lets us do things like look at large scale supply sheds for sourcing draws for companies, lets us predict what the outcomes will be on a specific field without having farmer data. But then when a farmer enrolls in a program, we get the real data and we model against real data. But up to that point, we can do it with, and really, one of the reasons SIBO started was to understand the food and agriculture system without having to have farmer data. It was a real problem to understand what's happening at scale,
sure,
from a field level scale to a national to a global scale without farmer data. And that was really where the company originated by our founding investor, Flagship Pioneering. That was the what if premise. How could we understand these large scale systems without having local data?
Because when it gets right down to it, if you were to ask a farmer to tell you his secrets, he probably wouldn't tell you his secrets when it gets right down to it. So unless you're part of his team, then he might tell you his secrets, right?
Yeah, they're very protective of their data. There's no question farmers value their data, rightfully so. But if you're part of their team, and we come with a different approach, when our partners come to the farmers, it's with money and help. We don't charge a farmer anything, right? Our objective is to help get them incentive dollars, help get them agronomic support. So in that sense, we are hopefully viewed as a good partner, a trusted partner, our partners that are deploying the programs are viewed as trusted partners of theirs.
So if I were to analogize, I would suggest what I hear you saying is that we're like the people who work with Ben and Jerry's to reduce the flatulence of cows.
Our partners are the technology enabling that. So
yes, right.
You think of,
right. So yeah, Ben and Jerry's is the one who's introducing and making cows more environmentally friendly.
And reducing the methane.
Yeah, and you're the one that can go to Ben and Jerry's and say, we can help you do that.
Yep.
And
yep.
Then,
so that's a good example. Ben and Jerry's could say, I want to roll out to 100, to 1,000 dairy farmers, and here's the program design. Use this product. We'll quantify the impact of the methane reduction so they can take credit for whatever reduction there was and deploy that program to a farmer. We tend to work more right now in kind of most of our work today, SIBO's work today, is across more of the traditional row crops,
sure,
corn, soybeans, canola, yeah. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of areas. But we do have more and more, there's more and more interest in doing dairy and grazing where there's a lot of methane. And methane is some 30 times more impactful than
so if you really want to make a difference, reduce the methane.
And rice growth generates a lot of methane, dairy cattle, grazing cattle, generate a lot of methane. So it is a high impact area. So is nitrous oxide, is another high impact area that you know, if they can come from the soil when you're, you know, have fertilizer in the soil. So there's areas that can provide a multiple of impact like those. They may be more difficult to do, but they definitely have a multiplier effect.
And in doing so, if you are able to do really be an effective at this, then your customers, the players like Ben and Jerry's or whoever, could then go to their customers who buy their ice cream and know that, hey, Ben and Jerry's was active in reducing the methane from cows, and therefore your ice cream is much more environmentally friendly, which helps you get to that magic label that people look for, but you haven't quite found yet with respect to regenerative, because we haven't figured out what exactly is regenerative.
What does it mean?
What does it mean?
There's some new companies coming out that are doing more work in this area where there's labeling on products, but there isn't a standard, you know, a USDA organic or prime or choice meat, you know, standard yet that applies to regenerative agriculture, because there's so many facets to what could contribute. But what they all do, I think what they're targeting to do is talk to their stakeholders, which could be their employees, their customers, and their shareholders, about what they're doing to get to net zero or reduce their footprint.
Right.
And that is where this really comes home, is when they can report back in their annual reports that they were able to achieve these reductions along their path towards net zero. And that affects, you know, everybody wants to see that happen, right? There's a lot of different stakeholders that are interested in that.
So in essence, what SIBO does, what SIBO offers agriculture, is one means of quantifying a qualitative process. So you could put the numbers on something that everybody wants to do.
Yep. That's a good way of saying it. Actually, we can take, here's a series of practices or processes that are the inputs, and then we can model what does that mean from a
So we know this process causes X amount of pollution. So if we do it the other way, this way, it will do much less. So
we model what the impact would be.
That's a big deal.
And then there's some cases, you know, some of the verification will require ultimately doing measurements or soil sampling or things like that. It depends on the requirements of the program. But the goal is, whatever they're trying to understand in terms of the impact of the practice, whether you, as you said, that's pollution or water quality or carbon, the goal is to have the ability to deliver that back to the sponsor.
Wow. So when you take your product, when you take SIBO out into the marketplace of the world, you're really looking for people, for businesses that are looking to make an impact on agriculture. And
that's the name of the product, SIBO Impact.
SIBO Impact. There you go.
Yeah.
And so you can actually put that on the table and say, you want to do this. We know everybody wants to do this. But if you do that, are you actually making a difference? And we can provide the actual difference. We can quantify the difference.
Yep.
And then you can use that difference as a marketing tool, or you can sell it as a climate benefit.
Yep. And I think the first thing we do before we do the impact quantification and reporting, whatever the impact is, carbon or other, the first thing we do is make it possible for them to efficiently develop and deliver a program to a farmer. That's part one. How do you do it? How do you get a program to farmer cost effectively? That is what we do with, you know, through our partnerships with these trusted advisors that actually come on our platform and develop, look at the programs on the platform and help the farmers deploy them. So that's really the first part. The second part then is what you said. Now tell me what happened, because I did those new things you asked me to do, that you asked me to do. What was the result of that? And that's the impact quantification.
And if you're a farmer, that's what you're always looking for too, because everybody's always promising farmers something. If you buy this, you'll get that.
Yeah.
How do I know? Well, you don't really know. But what you're actually doing is providing that quantifying that'll really make a difference for everybody concerned.
Yeah, I think one, we didn't talk much about it, but really the first problem we tried to solve in SIBO was making this a transparent process for farmers. Today, up till then, it's confusing. Here's a program from this company, and here's a promise from this company. And we try to be really transparent where the farmers can come in and quickly understand what might they be eligible for, what will they have to do, and what might they get paid if they do it. And that's really trying to just make it kind of an opaque system, very transparent, and provide optionality.
Then that's SIBO Technologies, and that's Dan Ryan, the CEO of SIBO Technology. I want to thank you for joining us today. And all of you out there, remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain: agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Mm-hmm. And you have any disagreement with that one, Dan?
Nope, I like it. I might adopt it.
Okay, please do. Just remember where you got it from, right? Okay.
Yeah, we'll do.
Thank you all out there for tuning in. Food Chain Radio program, Dan, with Dan Ryan, CEO of SIBO Technologies, making a difference in agriculture.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.